Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on a big step.
Oh!
Brother. Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at harborparoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann and I am very pleased to join in our continuing WrestleMania series is Bijan Bain, the author of Elgin Baylor, The Man Who Changed Basketball. Bijan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to chat about some of the highlights of the Celtics and Lakers finals rivalry between 1959 and 1969. They met seven times in the finals with the Celtics winning each time, but some very close calls there, including three game sevens during that time. We'll talk about some of the highlights of their rivalry. But first, I want to talk a little bit about Elgin Baylor. You wrote a book about him. And what made him so special as a player, and how important was he to the Lakers of that decade?
Okay, great question. Both great questions in terms of context. Some of the things that I felt and that I found made him special as a player were he is the first player to whom we can trace the style of play that we take for granted now, in the sense that he was a one-on-one offensive player from the wing who took his defender or defenders off the dribble. And from the dribble, no matter if it was 16 to 18, 20 feet out, ended up somewhere in the lane. And whether that meant improvising, whether it meant changing hands, whether it meant a spin based on how the defender reacted, adjusting the ball, bringing it down, bringing it back up, double clutching, all of those things that we see commonplace now, we can trace to Baylor in terms of anybody seeing them nationally. The other thing that made him important is that when the Lakers were still in Minneapolis, which they were the first time they met the Celtics in an NBA final in 59, as you know, his style of play and the electrifying nature of his appeal was such that Bob Short decided to move the team to Hollywood. And the NBA did not have a presence west of St. Louis before Baylor.
And you can really say, I mean, the way that that Bill Russell was a defensive pioneer in terms of the style and the effectiveness in which he played defense, Baylor in many ways was an offensive pioneer as well.
That's correct. They both sort of understood the game in a way that, obviously, in Russell's sense, it was almost the closest equivalent that the sport has ever had to a goalie or goalkeeper, and the way that that controls possessions and also starts fast breaks and allows people to cheat on defense. And in terms of Baylor, the fact that he was able to improvise in the lane, adjust shots, change hands and things of that nature, and was so not creative to be flashy, but creative based on what the defense dictated, inspired a generation of the Gus Johnsons, the Julius Irvings, the later on the Michael Jordans and the Dominique Wilkinses as players who slash and score and sort of adjust on the fly.
And you know, once the Lakers made it to Los Angeles, I mean, Baylor was so instrumental in really making LA evolved to become the basketball capital of the NBA and really American basketball.
That's correct. I wouldn't. Auerbach took offense at that statement at a press conference at the NBA All-Star game when Short was present in 63, or at least I know Fred Shouse, the Laker coach at the time, was. So he took offense because they hadn't won a title, and at that time, UCLA hadn't even won a national title. So I would say, Russell took a jab at that when they were flying back from LA after they had won the deciding game in, I believe, the 63 finals. But I would say in the sense that it is Baylor that, first of all, brings the league to Southern California, which is very important in terms of travel and having a second large media capital and just giving it big league status. And also, even though they didn't have the hardware to show that the Celtics did, and never did, but they did make, as you state, seven finals, and then UCLA starts winning. I think you can attribute a lot of what happened in terms of the interest in the game in Southern California that UCLA is the beneficiary of by 64 and 65 on the Goodrich and Erickson teams. And this is before Alcindor. When they won the first two titles, a lot of the kids were Southern California high school players. And I think the interest between 61, 63, and 64 attracted a lot of young men to a game that they hadn't been paying that much attention to before Baylor. And that made the high school game in the region stronger.
What about Jerry West comes along a couple years after Baylor, and they are really the co-stars of that team. What was their relationship like, and how did they sort of deal with a situation in which they definitely could have become rivals, or, you know, the egos could have gotten in a way and you know, perhaps, and it could have gotten toxic. But, you know, from my understanding, that didn't really happen with Baylor and West. They pretty much got along and had a good relationship.
Well, my research showed and interviews showed of people who were their contemporaries or teammates, such as the Hot Rod Hundleys and people of that nature. Although when West becomes a better player and more integral to the scoring, there's some professional pride there and things of that nature, because obviously there's not quite as many shots. Baylor averaged 38 in 61-62 and 30. Well, he averaged 34 in 61-62. I think that was the year where he missed 30 odd games to reserve duty. 38 the year before. And then when West becomes a higher scorer, there's a couple of things that happen. One, Baylor's knees weren't as strong, so it actually helped. But obviously he wasn't as much the lead person in the offense. Well, he still was, but it was like a tandem at that point. So I would say after 63, he becomes a tandem and a scoring duo. And the way that they handled it was, Baylor was obviously, as you state, a couple years ahead of him. Baylor was team captain, and Baylor was widely respected not only by West, but around the league. So guys like Russell looked up to him, Guy Rogers, Oscar Robertson, the Al Addleses, the Lenny Wilkinses, the Hal Greers, because he was sort of garrulous. He had a sort of a regal air, a lot of journalists describe it as. And West deterred to that the first few seasons. And then when West became more of an offensive threat, because they didn't have a third strong scorer, and because they were always relatively weak in the post, they complemented each other, and it never became something of a professional or ego rivalry.
For Baylor and Russell, you know, they had a lot of, they were, you know, Russell considered Baylor a peer and a friend. They would go to movies and dinners together, and also, you know, both recognized their importance to the game. They had a lot of parallels as well in terms of, activism inside and outside the NBA, in terms of, speaking out on, social issues. They both were really important in terms of labor rights for the players, and they both, Baylor being the first, but both within a few months of each other, boycotted NBA games, or these are preseason games, Baylor in Charleston, West Virginia, Russell later in Dallas, and then again with the Celtics in Lexington, Kentucky. Can you tell the story about Baylor in Charleston?
Sure. To be fair, the Charleston game was in mid-January, so he was the first player to boycott a game because of accommodation discrimination during the regular season. In January of 59, when Elgin Baylor was a rookie, as you well know, and some of your listeners may or may not, the NBA used to schedule games mostly in the regular season, but mostly in the preseason, but sometimes during the regular season in cities where they could take advantage of the appeal of a player on the roster of either team who had played college ball there. The Boston often did it because of Frank Ramsey. They would play in Lexington, not as often during the regular year, but mostly during preseason. The Lakers played in Charleston to take advantage of the fact that Hot Rod Hundley was on the roster, former West Virginia All-American. So when the game was promoted, it was promoted by a group of Charleston business officials, and they put up the resources for the game. They marketed the game. They advertised the game. They took the financial burden. When the team arrived to make it kind of brief here, they were checking in, and at that time, Vern Mickelson was one of the captains, a gentleman who was a remnant from the Mikan years, and big blonde guy, 6'7". They're at the front desk in Charleston, and Ed Fleming and Boo Ellis and Baylor are all waiting with the rest of the guys, Dick Garmaker and Bob Slick Leonard. And as they're registering, the desk clerk looks at their ethnic makeup and says, you know, they can't all stay here. Well, Short had written the hotel in advance and made it clear that there were four Negroes on the team, and there hadn't been any resistance to him when he asked if that would cause any complications regarding lodging. So this was a surprise. And so when Mickelson is just getting the names and the number of keys and the room numbers and things like that, this was something that caught everyone off guard. And Baylor was within enough earshot to tell that the desk clerk was having issues. What results that night is that because the four black players have to stay unscheduled in a segregated rooming house, Baylor decided not to play. He thought about it, but something happened also when they went out to eat and they weren't served there. So he thought about it and decided not to play. Now, the game is to market or take advantage of Hundley's appeal. So when they're in the locker room, Hundley looks at him and says, "You're not dressing out." And he said, "No, Rod, I'm not going to play." And he said, "That's really, you know, a tough thing because this is my home crowd and I kind of understand, but could you change your mind?" And he said, "No, I'm not an animal to be let out of a cage." And then the Russell boycotts come later. But the thing to remind ourselves is that Baylor was a rookie. So he didn't have the standing of a Russell. He wasn't a veteran. He didn't have the standing with media. He didn't have standing in the public eye. So he risked that as a rookie.
Yeah, and obviously it took a lot of courage to do that. And what was the relationship between Baylor and Russell like? Did you find anything interesting about that in your research?
Sure. Baylor and Russell, as serious as they were on the court and as, you know, take your heart foot on the throat, Michael Jordan types or predecessors of Michael Jordan in terms of their will and their attitude and their professionalism. Because the league was still under an unspoken racial quota, they were quite friendly. Three or four blacks per team in the late 50s, early 60s, by 61 or 62, maybe five on some teams. And because of lodging and things of that nature, the guys drew close. Russell comes out of college about 2 years ahead of Baylor, but they're pretty close in age because Baylor actually was born in 34 and so was Russ. So just to give you an example of how genial they were, there's an incident where Russell finds out in the mid-60s that the Lakers are going to wear these royal blue blazers when they're on the road, you know, when they're on flights and things like that, a team jacket. and they had to decide which shade of blue. And when Russell heard the story, he said, how diplomatic of Mr. Baylor to decide that it was okay to let them wear this particular shade of blue. So they were big teasers.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, from what I've read, absolutely, Russell had, you know, he loved pranks. He had a great sense of humor, and Baylor was very like was chatty and was, you know, kind of constantly or consistently was just, you know, gregarious and engaging and that kind of thing. So going to some of the highlights of their of the finals in which they faced off. The 59 finals were a sweep by the Celtics, so not a whole lot going on there. But the fact that, you know, Baylor as a rookie was able to take this team to the finals, year in which he won Rookie of the Year, finished top 10 in scoring, rebounding, and assists, and then also managed 55 points in a game, which was the third highest total of all time at that point in the league. Says a lot about him with, you know, a couple of younger players who would kind of stick around for a few years, but really mostly aging veterans. Mickelson, who had, you know, been with the original Minneapolis Lakers dynasty, and then guys like, you know, Dick Garmaker and Larry Faust, who, you know, were many time all-stars, but were, you know, at the end of their career.
That's right. In that series, they were swept. The first two games were in Boston. The first game was close. It was 118-115. The deciding game was relatively close, 118-113. But the Celtics were a veteran club in a good way, in the sense that Cousy was not on his last legs. Neither was Sharman. Heinsohn was only in his third year. Russell was only in his third year. And Russell only played half of his first year because of the Olympics. So they were fresh. So they had a good mix of young, youth, and veteran. The Lakers had Baylor and Warren veterans. So that wasn't a very balanced series, in the sense that the Minneapolis got to that finals despite having a losing record during the regular season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 33-39. They managed to upset the Hawks, who had were in the midst of 4 out of 5 finals and would really be a fierce rival for the Lakers for toward the end of the 50s and most of the 60s. Not really that remembered of a rivalry now, but they absolutely went back and forth a lot, with the Hawks getting the better for the most part of those early years, and then the Lakers breaking through and having the better of those later years.
That's right. The Lakers and the Hawks for most of the very late 50s and very early 60s till about 63 almost met annually in the Western Finals. And when they did, the Hawks still had the triumvirate of Pettit, Hagen, and Lavellette. And Hagen and Baylor went at it because they were both, even by the standards of those times, undersized forwards. Hagen was only about 6'4". Mm-hmm. He was about Frank Ramsey size. So They would guard each other for the most part. They were both physical. They were both sort of gliders. Hagen had their running hook no one could block. And I interviewed Hagen for my Baylor biography, and he says that he had good games against Elgin, and he was as quick as Elgin, that Elgin was the first really, really dynamic scorer and the first really the kind of person that you were tempted to double team and things of that nature. But because they were about the same size, roughly the same age, although Hagen was not on the Kentucky team that Baylor played in the NCAA finals, it was that Hawk team was a very high-scoring, three All-Star savvy veteran team in one of the most still segregated NBA markets. So there was a lot going on socially and in terms of rivalry when they played one another, because, as you know, In the very late 50s, they were the only team to take a championship off the Russell Celtics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So moving on to 62, the Lakers, of course, are in Los Angeles now. Jerry West has joined the team and is in his second season. This is the season that Baylor only plays 48 games because of military service, but he has just an extraordinary scoring average. They're now coached by Fred Schaus, who was Wes' college coach. This one goes seven games. Baylor ends up scoring 65 points in game five, which is a Lakers win. And Russell has 189 rebounds in this series, which is the most in a seven-game series. He averages 27 a game. And then the 62 final game, the Celtics win 110-107 in overtime. The second game seven in the finals to go into overtime. Most famously, Frank Selvey has a wide open jump shot with 5 seconds left, but he misses, and the Celtics are able to grab it in overtime thanks to Sam Jones hitting some key shots in overtime. Russell had 30 points and 40 rebounds. Really about as close as they could possibly get, and this would be the first instance of the Lakers just coming so incredibly close to beating the Celtics and not being able to pull it off.
Yes, that's the first year where West is really an all-star caliber player, so it's becoming more of a balanced team. The obvious glaring deficiency would be having a Ray Felix in the pivot versus a Russell. Not so much that you're giving up away that much in points, but in the other two important aspects of the game, defense and rebounding, and even Russell's passing ability and ability to get on the break. Felix wasn't a bad player, but it's just that this was the first of many finals when the discrepancy in the under the basket was so evident when the teams appeared so balanced on paper. First game, Boston won in Boston. Less than 8,000 people turned out. Lakers won game two in Boston. It's a high scoring series, as you can tell by the number of rebounds and points that Russell had. Obviously, the Baylor game where he has what is still an NBA Finals record, even after the Jordan years, is still a Finals record. A lot of possessions. It's really, if you look at it, because Cousy is still there, you still have prime Heinsohn, you still have prime Casey Jones, a burgeoning West, not quite the West of the mid-60s, but a high-scoring, a fast West, and a West that many fans didn't see or even see in highlights on YouTube is the West in the early 60s was actually a person that could elevate. You know, if he got one on a breakaway, and he was prone to getting his share of steals, he would dunk it. And he had the long arms. He had played forward at West Virginia. So to see West in a box score now at 6'3", it's a little deceptive because he was really an athletic player, mixed it up on defense a lot. Mm-hmm. So that's a really athletic sort of a new wave finals in the sense that you got these guys like Sanders and Russell and Casey Jones, who was drafted by the Rams, and Sam Jones, who was supposed to be the fastest player afoot in the league, Russell, who could have high jumped in the 56 Olympics, Baylor, West, going against each other, hammer and tong for seven games.
Yeah. So moving on to 63, they would face off again the next year, and They're fairly similar teams, although John Havlicek is a rookie for the Celtics, and this is Cousy's last season. The Lakers added Dick Barnett, who had came after a year in the ABL, along with Leroy Ellis and Gene Wiley. Actually, this is probably a pretty good time to talk about just in general kind of the supporting cast that Baylor and West had in the 60s, because it definitely, there were some people who, who stuck around. Tom Hawkins he was there and then left and then came back. Rudy LaRusso was there for a few seasons, who were kind of some of the key guys who really were, the good role players that, that people might not know about, other than, obviously, behind West and Baylor.
Well, that's a very good question, because it gives fans who, I wasn't around, of course, it gives fans a feel for how well matched they were or how poorly matched they might have been. And you say well or poorly, a lot of years they did go seven games, despite the fact that Russell is in the post. Rudy LaRusso was an All-American from Dartmouth. He was 6'7"-ish, but he had good jump shooting range from the baseline, rugged rebounder. Fans that are a little younger, that obviously couldn't have seen this series, but maybe if a fan was around in the early 70s or mid 70s and saw Dave DeBuscher, I would say there's a little bit of LaRusso and DeBuscher's game. There's some later analogs that I could provide of people who played in the 80s or the 90s. So that's a good strong forward and a good sort of juxtaposition for a Heinsohn in terms of a duel. And Heinsohn didn't have a lot of wind, as you well know, in terms of just going being able to go 30, 28 minutes at a time. The addition of a Barnett sort of takes the onus off West a little bit because it gives them a good balanced backcourt of whom both could score, both could take you off the dribble. Dick Barnett was a left-handed jump shooter, unusual jump shot in terms of his style, of course, with the leg kick, but a good defender, and that helped West a lot. Adding Gene Wiley and Leroy Ellis in the 62-63 draft was pivotal because they were young big men. They were younger than Russell. They could both run. Wiley was a leaper. He could block shots. Ellis had a nice jump shot. He was also very fast. He'd been a first-team All-American at St. John's. So that gives them a little bit more depth in the post, but they're rookies facing Russell. And then you have... You have Frank Selby, who's a little bit long in the tooth by that stage, as was Cousy. So I would say the key element is that Barnett and LaRusso, while they both had double-digit years that they played in the NBA and were very strong scorers up in the teens per year, and then some years Barnett, when he played enough minutes, would average in the low 20s, Heinsohn, Cousy, and eventually Havlicek are all Hall of Famers. And that's a major difference. Of course, Havlicek is a rookie in the 63 finals, so he doesn't play as much, but a very athletic rookie.
Yeah. And he was hurt for a few games in the series, although he closed it out and played pretty well closing it out. Now, West had been injured for about 7 weeks at the close of the season, so he was back during the playoffs, but the team didn't necessarily... hadn't worked out all the kinks. In fact, both division series went 7 games. The Celtics beat the Royals and the Lakers beat the Hawks. Of course, the Lakers and Hawks commonly had 7-game series. And the Celtics won a lot of 7-game series in the Eastern Division Finals. That was the peak for the Royals that year.
Jerry Lucas was probably a rookie.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yes.
If he wasn't still with the Pipers, he may not have even been there yet.
I think the ABL was done by then, but yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
The teams actually played 9 times during the regular season in 62-63, and the Lakers won 5 out of the 9 to give you a sense of the balance. But then Russell has this other level that he goes to in the finals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This was a very – by the way, Jerry Lucas, his first year was 64, so he was there the next year.
Okay, he was in limbo, yeah.
Yeah. But obviously Oscar, Jack Twyman, strong teams there.
They were both exhausted coming in. I mean,
exactly. Yes.
There's no charter travel back then.
No, there definitely is not. So, and yeah, some of the amount of time between games was brutal as well. I mean, there were, back to back to backs and all that sort of stuff. And the travel is harder and, so many things that we kind of, the schedule today is tough in many respects, but so many things that are probably taken for granted today, are difficult. But even though the Celtics won this game in 5 of the 6 games were very close, including the clincher in game 6, in game 5, the Lakers were down 3-1 at this point. But Heinsohn is ejected. Cousy fouls out with only 12 points. And Baylor has 43 and West has 32 as the Lakers win 126-119. In game 6, Havlicek is able to – he scores 11 straight during one first-half stretch. Boston's up – they're up pretty good late, up with by 9 with 11 minutes left, but Cousy injures his ankle, doesn't return until the 5-minute mark, and then by then the Lakers cut the lead to a single point. And then the Celtics are holding on, but Heinsohn stoles a Jerry West pass to Rui LaRusso, driving and scoring. And from there, basically, Cousy tries to work the clock, dribbling out the last seconds and ending his career by throwing the ball high into the air. A very tremendous series, but another in a series of close but great wins by the Celtics.
Yes, that's the second heartbreaking loss of the what we now can look back at retrospect as game seven or close series heartbreaking losses. Now it's starting to frustrate the highly competitive West and the highly competitive Baylor. Obviously, Shouse. When Shouse is asked about it, he always points to Russell. Russell is, of course, the major difference, although there are other differences. Cousy at that point is about 35. But there's so many momentum switches. The Lakers at that point, if we just put ourselves in real time, are hoping that Wiley and or Ellis will mature enough to at least give Russell a run for his money as the Celtics get older, and that Baylor and West, obviously with West being Baylor's junior, will still provide a 30 to 25 point each a game scoring punch should they ever meet again.
And it's funny in retrospect because already the talk of, oh, maybe the Celtics are too old is coming along. And granted, you know, Cousy was toward the end here and was important and was, you know, and was considered a major part of the team. Although even after he left, they got even better. And Russell was still, you know, he was in his late 20s, but he wasn't quite old yet. And you got an infusion of youth with Havlicek. So they were getting older, but it's funny that
it's sort of misleading though, because when Cousy and Sharman started from 57 to 61 ish, they had the Jones boys.
Right. Exactly.
So it's very misleading because you have two Hall of Famers, Sam and Casey Jones, sort of biding their time behind Cousy and Sharman. And I know Sharman's not there in 63, but the larger point is that, you know, you sort of had Sam all along and you got KC.
Yeah, right. I mean, they were just so great at, I mean, obviously in the talent that they chose and in figuring out that whole, you know, mentor relationship with the older players of, you know, kind of, you know, showing the younger players along, or at least giving them kind of an archetype to play, and then mm-hmm. you know, the younger players filling those roles and adjusting things as needed, but still, it's amazing how well-oiled machine the Celtics were, and I guess that's how you win 11 titles in 13 years.
Yeah, I don't know if they would have stayed had there been free agency, whether Havlicek would wait for a Heinsohn to get older or whether Sam would wait for a Sharman or Cousy to get older. It may be if you're winning rings every year, but then again, are you winning rings every year if there's free agency?
Yeah, and a bigger, lot more teams and a lot more playoff rounds to get through. And yeah, obviously it's a different landscape.
Yeah.
So moving on to 65, this is a tough one for the Lakers because they lose Baylor. He plays 5 minutes in game one of the division finals series against the Bullets and suffers a serious knee injury. Basically, he said he went up for a shot and my knee exploded. I could hear a crack and a pop and everything else, and his kneecap is almost a split and extremely serious injury. Really remarkable that he came back from it at all, and came back from it definitely a lessened player, but still an effective player for, you know, a number of years after this.
That's correct. The 65-66 finals were relatively anticlimactic because of a hobbling Baylor, although he was able to help them get into the finals again, which was rather surprising because Baltimore had a strong young team. But again, that's the series where he's hurt. They still had Barnett. So the thing about Barnett is if Baylor's out or if Baylor is 65%, Barnett can take more shots and provide some additional scoring punch. But without the weapon that Baylor had been 2 or 3 years earlier, it allows the Celtics to play them differently.
Mm-hmm. West
and Boston won the opener by 32 points, just to give you a feel for how different.
Yes, absolutely. West was able to get 45 in game two, but Boston still won that one. It was a closer margin, 129-123. The Lakers did win game three. West had 43 points and Leroy Ellis had 29 points. They won that one pretty handily, but they couldn't match up with them in game five. Was a pretty dominant Celtics win, 129-96. The Celtics outscored the Lakers 72-48 in the second half, and Boston ran off 20 unanswered points. The Lakers went scoreless for 5 minutes, and in one stretch, West missed 14 out of 15 shots. So just a, Lakers clearly didn't have enough in that series. And that was probably, that may have been the peak Celtics team in terms of how they performed in the regular season. And they beat a really tough Sixers team who had just added Wilt Chamberlain in seven games. That was the really first tough 76ers series that, of course, they would deal with in the Eastern Conference for the next few years.
That's correct. That's the Havlicek stole the ball series, yes. In which, although the Celtics, the Russell hit the guy wire before the timeout, trying to inbound ball. Very strong physical team with Luke Jackson and Greer and Walker and those guys. The thing about that whole playoff run, because of what happened to Baylor, West had to score more, and just to keep them alive. So from the Baltimore series throughout, he averaged 40.6 points through the Celtics series. So he's able to turn it on, but it just took a lot out of him because he also had a lot of defensive responsibilities with the best defensive guard on the opposite side. And although Barnett helped, it just shows you at that point how advanced West was becoming in his career, that he could take it up to that level and average almost 41 points a game throughout the entire postseason.
Yeah. And he's a guy who, West throughout his career, just, frequently battled various ailments. I mean, broke his nose, I think a half a dozen or more times, just continuously would, battle through these ailments and still obviously be, effective in the vast majority of situations.
Yeah, one of the best clutch players in the history of the league. Certainly one of the best finals players, maybe top two, if not, at least arguably top three finals players in the history of the league.
Sure. Well,
when you say finals players, you can't just account for offense, because you have to put Russell in there, because you're always thinking West Jordan. But what about somebody who can control a seven game series without having the ball in his hands, which is Russell?
Yeah, that is, and obviously the winning record's pretty hard to argue with as well, just being in so many of them and winning every time in close situations. I mean, that's like you said, we've talked a lot about how what Russell did is a little bit harder to measure than what other players do, just because some of those things don't necessarily show up in the stat sheet. But we have footage somewhat, but we don't have the full account of every single game and everything that he did. But still, we know enough to know that he meant a lot, and certainly in that conversation.
Well, we have to take your hat off to Russell. I wrote a piece for Slam Online once, and I said, here's a man who perfected a craft for which there was no financial or statistical reward, because they didn't log that statistic until 1973, 4 years after he retired. How many people go out and perfect something and take pride in it and know how pivotal it is to the outcome of the game that's not going to show up in the box score? The skill for which he's known for, people didn't even count from 1957 to 1969. Yeah. So that shows you that he was blocking shots, because blocking shots changes the tempo, the outcome, the intimidation, the thinking of the shooter in the game. He wasn't blocking shots because, oh, I'm going to lead the league in block shots this year, or I'm going to lead the league in finishing on the break, or I'm going to lead the league in guys who make an attempt to make a shot, but I don't actually block the shot, but I change the shot. People weren't counting those things. I don't even think they were counting defensive rebounds.
Yeah.
That's genius.
Right. Absolutely. And the fact that he, you know, had a coach in Red Auerbach who, you know, wasn't worried about his stats and value, didn't maybe couldn't even quite always understand what he did, why he was so effective, but understood that, you know, what he was contributing to winning basketball, and, you know, and not worrying about the scoring totals, and just, you know, understanding that, you know, he was playing to win and that he was effective in winning. And, you know, the fact that they had such, you know, a remarkable relationship and trust in each other, and Auerbach was, you know, kind of contrary to his gruff image, was actually very collaborative with the players and sought mm-hmm. their ideas and treated them like adults. I mean, you know, the Lakers were actually a pretty well run organization during the time. I mean, they, you know, they had some ownership mm-hmm. changes, and they had, you know, they had coaching changes and so forth. And they had, you know, definitely had some players come in and out. But I mean, just the fact that the Celtics just had that stability and had just such a consistent program that worked so well. I mean, they were just, you know, head and shoulders above everyone, not just in players, but in terms of kind of creating that culture.
Yes, they had an attitude when they walked onto the floor. They warmed up. If you're Oscar in the Royals on the other end, or Pettit in the Hawks, or Baylor in the Lakers, even though these are the best players in the world, they've already got the championships. Havlicek's got his rings from Ohio State. Russell has his from San Francisco. Ramsey has won, and KC has won at San Francisco. And they've got Auerbach, who's going to light the cigar. And they've got this attitude. They're like the clean-cut Raiders. They make you mad. They make you want to defeat them. But they've got these winners who are cocky, but not cocky in the way that we associate with sort of the renegade or rebel teams in pro sports, but more of a sort of an all-American cocky, maybe more analogous to the Yankees of the 50s and 60s. And the psychological, the barrier of beating them, especially knowing that they've got the mental champion, Russell, was something in the way that Auerbach picked those players, because you can't see what Havlicek really is in college. You can kind of see what Russell is in college, but most general managers wouldn't have appreciated Russell in college because scoring was such a big deal.
Yeah, and it's hard to see what's, you know, obviously college isn't televised that much, and you know Auerbach had, I think, seen Russell once before he drafted him, and a lot of these times you weren't able to see guys. You had to rely, of course, on you know, word of mouth or people that you trusted and scouting and so forth. Just a completely different changed situation.
That's right.
So the 66 finals, the Celtics win 4-3. This is Auerbach's final series as coach. The Lakers won game one in overtime, 133-129. It was in Boston. West had 41. Baylor had 36. Baylor recovered from the knee injury, as we mentioned, was no longer, you know, West was clearly the number one option after that, but was still very important to the team, and, you know, could put up some big scoring performances, not quite as consistently, but again, just remarkable that he dealt with so much pain recovering from that knee injury and powering through that pain. And, you know, it was a sort of a question as to whether he was really going to ever be able to play and to power through that and to play, you know, pretty effectively is quite remarkable.
Yeah, he went through the psychological something himself in 63, mostly 64. Obviously, when he hurts it against the Bullets in 65, 66. Of how hard can I go and test it without risking being sidelined again? And with the style of play of him being a floater and a glider, a guy that shot a lot of runners, twisting in midair, I just can't imagine having to adapt and having to tweak your game when it's predicated on explosiveness and still be effective and be a serviceable, I don't want to say serviceable because it makes it sound sort of mediocre, but to be a dependable player for 4 to 5 more years, especially after the surgery to the second knee. And the opponents knew it too, so there was different ways that they could defense you after that. But his leadership, his ability to still time rebounds, the fact that he was still a very efficient and visionary passer, made him a valuable player even when he didn't have the lift that he had in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm. And the Lakers had added Bob Boozer and Gail Goodrich this year. And so some of that cast was rotating. Don Nelson went over to the Celtics and ended up being a key player for the Celtics, starting with 66. Before game two, Auerbach announced that Russell would be the next head coach, of course, becoming the first black coach in professional sports history. The Celtics then won the next three games of the series, but the final four games of the series were all pretty close. Fred Shouse actually put Gail Goodrich in the starting lineup and moved West over to forward, which kind of helped the Lakers win in games 5 and 6. So it's all tied 3-3, and then the final game. Another very close game, but unfortunately for the Lakers, another close outcome is 95-93. Russell had 25 points and 32 rebounds in this game. Sam Jones had 22 points. West had 36, while Baylor struggled in the game at 19 points, but on 6 of 22 shooting. Another instance of the Celtics taking a big lead, but the Lakers coming back, the lead was down to 6 points with 20 seconds left. Red actually lit the victory cigar, but there were some untimely turnovers for the Celtics, and the Lakers cut the lead to 95-93 with 4 seconds left. By this time, the fans kind of got a little bit crazy and were, you know, rushing the court and there was kind of mayhem. Eventually, Casey Jones got the inbounds pass to Havlicek, and he dribbled out the clock for the championship. But another crazy scene, not quite the one key moment, but another definitely heartbreaking situation for the Lakers again.
That's right. In that game, Baylor actually managed to average, and we say this because of his legs, managed to average 27 points and 14 rebounds in that finals. But, you know, there again, there's good runs and bad runs. And West had a 2-for-9 shooting run in that deciding game. That was another game where Freddie Shouse experimented with a small ball lineup of the three guards to supposedly exploit the quickness and sort of take advantage of Sam and KC being elder. The other things about that game, it's very significant that you noted that back in those days, the fans could basically stand, if you see footage of those things when, you know, the clock is being dribbled out in that game or in the 62 final, you could pretty much stand where the parquet floor ended in that arena and ring the court almost like you would for a summer league game. So it was dangerous. Things got thrown when the visiting team, you could hear everything. When the ball went out of play, it was dangerous for the players because the fans were that close, as were the camera staff. So it's a little, it's a window into a different NBA than we have now in terms of just the configuration of how the game is viewed and the interaction between fan and player. Very almost sort of a remnant of the 50s almost. So that's kind of the atmosphere that game was played in. And it's kind of, Auerbach took advantage of the effect that it would have on media and on the Lakers and on the Celtics and on Russell by naming Russell his successor during the series. And that's when the three-game Boston winning streak started, is when Russell was named the next coach. Mm-hmm. Because he had announced in the 65-66 preseason that was going to be his final year. But he asked a few people. He asked Cousy, who was happy coaching Boston College. He asked Carl Braun. He asked a few people. None of them were interested. It's not like now, if you're a championship team, everybody would be interested. Guys were car dealers or insurance men. They weren't interested. And
yeah, And some
being a barrier breaker and breaking that racial barrier seemed like it just changed the tenure of the series. Not that the Lakers probably would have won anyway, but it's interesting the timing of that.
Yeah, and definitely, Fred Shouse wasn't really thought that he was upset by that, thinking it sort of stole their thunder, and he was not a big fan of Red Auerbach. I guess you kind of get through over the years, and frankly, I guess when you lose that much to one guy, you're going to get frustrated by him, but. Thinking about those atmospheres, I mean, it's pretty crazy how, those environments could be really intimidating and could be really, for players to a certain extent and for refs too. There definitely were some, home court advantage was an even greater quality in the 50s and 60s than it is today, in terms of, the usual result. And a lot of that, I'm sure, came from just the psychological factor of fans being able to actually be intimidating in whether it was implied threats or whether it was actually, throwing things in there. Those are difficult environments to play in, and that can have a psychological effect on what you're trying to do in there.
Yeah, I would say that was a vestige of the NBA's sort of minor league-ish status before. Yes. Chamberlain, Robertson, Baylor, Pettit was already in the league, but it was sort of, the still not showing the games until tape delay and finals games not being on national television and weird broadcast teams that you see back in those days of like, why is this guy in the booth, and broadcast strikes and. I think Chet Forty of ABC had to do one game because there was a broadcaster strike, so he had to call the game, and he was a producer.
Right.
So
yeah,
still struggling to catch up with the NFL and Major League Baseball.
Sure.
And the status, the Major League status that they had was a credit to the fact that they had Chamberlain, Robertson, West, Baylor, and Russell. Not so much the travel or the pay, or the union rights, or the fan behavior.
Yeah, and they'd taken strides in those areas, but yes, it was definitely still, it's shocking to see today, and certainly, on the scale of things, it was still closer to the minor leagues than maybe we would like to think sometimes.
Yep.
So 1968 finals, the Celtics win 4-2, the Lakers had a little bit of an easier time getting through the playoffs. They beat the Bulls 4-1, and they swept the Warriors. Those games were all pretty close, but they were able to sweep that series. The Celtics beat the Pistons in the first round, and then took the 76ers again to 7. This was a year after the Sixers had beaten the Celtics to end the eight-year title streak.
That's right. The Boston too old year.
Yes, yes. And Russell was in his second season as player coach. The Lakers had a new coach in Butch Van Bredekoff, and he was sort of a kind of a salt of the earth, gruff personality, but would very, would be honest maybe to a fault, as I think Jerry West put it, that you can't really treat professional players the way that Van Predlikoff treated people, and that would lead to big issues in the next season. But the Lakers started off a little bit slow, but they actually went 38-9 in the final half of the season or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the series was, there are fewer close games than there generally were in the Celtics Lakers series. In game five, West, he suffered an ankle injury in game four. He came back though and scored 35 points. The Celtics jumped to a big lead, but, the Lakers came back to, tie the score at 108 apiece. And the Lakers were down by 4 with less than a minute to play. West stole the ball and found Baylor down court for a layup. They tied it when Archie Clark, he got another steal and West scored. But in overtime, Russell blocked a Baylor shot, and Don Nelson hit a late free throw to give Boston a 120-117 win and a series lead. Game six didn't was more of a blowout. 124-109, the Celtics won. Havlicek had 40 points, and Russell moved Sam Jones to forward, where he posted Goodrich up and forced Van Breedlikhoff to go with a taller, slower lineup. So this was an example of Russell, again, in his second year as player coach, showing some chops as he gained more experience as a coach.
That's right. That's an interesting series. It's not as well recounted in the lore as some of the other ones that we've talked about. We're probably not the last one that we'll talk about in terms of the folklore. But it's important in the sense of, as you said, there's the coaching change, the first of a couple. There'll be a player change the next year. And it's Van Breedlikhoff coming from coaching at Princeton. Jack Kent Cook sees a Sports Illustrated magazine cover with two Princeton players on the cover and asks who their coach is. And someone says, well, their coach is this guy named Butch Van Breedlikhoff. And he hires him. Turns out he had taken Princeton to the Final Four with Bill Bradley and was seen as sort of a rah-rah guy by the professional players. At this point in the rivalry, it's really on West's shoulders to sort of try to keep the series competitive. And it's Russell's charge to become sort of our Auerbach 2.0 in trying to psych out the opponent.
Yeah, and he was able to really meet that challenge. And I love the quote from Russell after the series is done. The reporter asked him what he had left to accomplish, and he said, "Well, I don't know, because I never had a goal. To tell you the truth, it's been a long time since I tried to prove anything to anybody. I know who I am." Which is whether he feels that way or not, that's definitely a standout Bill Russell thing to say.
Yeah, and the thing is, Russell had a lot of respect for Baylor and West.
Yes.
Not only because they were annual finals rivals, but because they didn't, you know, they never took a playoff. They never mailed it in. They were both injury prone. Well, not, I would say West wasn't necessarily injury prone. West did a lot of diving for loose balls and things like that that led to facial injuries, whereas Baylor's injuries were leg injuries, which is your career if you're a floater. So there are different types of injuries. West was always lionized in the press for his injuries and for playing through them, because you could see his face. It was like a football player, the way he looked. Baylor was not as lionized for playing through his, which is a little bit unfair and probably speaks to a little bit about where the society was in terms of white athletic heroes and black athletic heroes, because West was treated like the hobbling Mickey Mantle type. But it was Baylor who had the kind of injuries that Mantle had, which were knee injuries.
Sure.
It's not to say that journalists didn't say that he was heroic, but they always said West was heroic because of all the, because I guess you could quote and always use in your column the number of broken noses, and that was just an easy copy.
Yeah.
So Russell really, really, really respected those guys. I mean, because those were fights. And again, back to this whole thing about getting out of the Eastern Division. I mean, Russell is beating Chamberlain in the Eastern Finals most of these years. So it's really in an 11-team league, a 9-team league, a 13-team league. It's really something that you have to think about, that in a way that we don't now, about series in which you know all your opponent's pet moves, you know all the coaches' mindset and strategies and idiosyncrasies and tricks, the refs, the fans. It's a very insular league. You talked about guys hanging out, especially among the black players, because there's still sort of unspoken quotas about how many blacks to have per team. And it's almost like a high school league in the sense of the familiarity.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, there's still, you know, up through 67, there's 9-10 teams in the league. Expansion's about to really blow that up. But, yeah, I mean, there is, you would play these teams so many times, you would get to know them so well. The familiarity was there. The also helped that there was much more roster stability. So, you know, these teams aren't changing their identity necessarily as quickly as you know, as we might see today. I mean, you know, there were certainly, I mean, there were coaching changes a lot, and certainly there was player movement, but it definitely was a completely different thing at this point. I mean, teams could keep players basically as long as they wanted to. So, and obviously the Celtics, you know, kept the same system and the same crew, obviously changed with age, but, you know, you could count on what the Celtics were doing. You had a hard time stopping it because they were so good, but you obviously knew what they were doing. So,
well, they had replaceable parts. They would have this part of the small, they would have this part of the strong forward. And first it was Luskatov, and then later it's, you know, someone else. And then it becomes, you know, in latter years, you know, Bailey Howell sort of fills that role. Then Steve Kuberski, then Silas, then McHale. And they have sort of this stopper at guard. You know, it's DJ, but before DJ, it's Don Chaney. But before Don Chaney, it's Casey Jones. But before him, it's Frank Ramsey. And then Havlicek can sort of play Swiss knife. He can guard a forward and a guard.
Yeah.
You have, you know, the center who can play defense. It could be Parrish, or it could be Cowens, or it could be Russell. I'm not saying that their talents are equal, but they sort of have these movable parts, sort of like a John Thompson Georgetown team. That's probably where Thompson got it from, since he was Russell's backup. And in that league, as you said, it's always going to be Robertson, Twyman, Lucas. It's always going to be West, Baylor. The difference with the Lakers is they had Boozer, then they let him go. That's like a 16, 17 point scorer who can add extra punch to supplement Baylor and West. And Baylor always felt it was a mistake letting him go to New York. They had Nelson and they let him go. Baylor always felt letting Nelson go was a mistake. When you take a guy, Boozer didn't play for Boston, but when you take a guy like Nelson and you plug him into a Celtics team that's already got multiple championships and the role is lessened and he's a role player and he's making these key shots, but everybody else is double teamed and he's getting these open shots. It's a big difference than when you're playing in LA. Mel counts. A couple of guys played for both, you know, for both franchises. It's different how one franchise used them and the other franchise is like, yeah, you can come here and just be you. We're going to win and you're just a piece.
Sure. So moving on to our finals, the 1969 finals, the Celtics win 4-3. Wilt Chamberlain joins the Lakers in the offseason, and of course, you know, joining West and Baylor, it's you consider a triumphant acquisition by Jack Kent Cooke, and they absolutely, you know, looking like the favorites to dominate the league and finally beat the Celtics. Celtics really were a big underdog in this series. They were only 48-34. They were the fourth seed. It was the first time the Lakers had home court advantage against the Celtics. It looked like it was going to be a big mismatch, but the Celtics managed to, you know, upset the Sixers in the first round and beat the Knicks, who were about to be a rising power in the East.
That's the year where Russell had been in the league since 57 and Jones had been in the league since 67. So people are like, you know, I know this isn't prime Baylor, but you got Weston Wilt and then you got Sam and Russ. And Havlicek's an all-star by then, or at least on the verge of becoming one with enough minutes. And, you know, on paper, you're like, really? Bill Russell in his 13th year and Sam Jones in his 13th year are going to beat these three guys?
Yeah, but the Celtics were kind of able to, they were able to rally once more, even though, you know, it was clear that Russell was waning a bit. You know, Sam Jones had some rough times during the season, but they were able to kind of pull it all together in the playoffs and able to pull through. Before we go through some of the big highlights of the series, I just want to talk about the Lakers acquiring Wilt and how mm-hmm. Wilt's personality worked in the locker room, particularly with Elgin.
Okay, well, initially, the Lakers had entertained the thought of bringing Chamberlain in since 65 in the deal where he went from San Francisco to Philly. They thought about it even then. Shouse asked Baylor what he thought about bringing in Wilt in 65, and he asked West, which gives you a feel for the standing that West had by that time as a five-year vet. And there's no transcript of exactly what they told Fred Shouse or what they told their GM Lou Mose, but you get the impression that they discouraged it without saying that they thought that there was anything wrong with Wilt, just the chemistry nature of it. Because at that point, he hadn't won. Elgin loved him. I mean, he was Elgin's best man. When they did bring him in, it's the unselfish Wilt. It's the shot blocker. It's the passer. It's the guy who's had the most assists in the league one year in Philly. It's the guy who had the best winning record of all time with the 66-67 Sixers of 68-13. It's not sort of the Wilt that needs to be a gun, not to take anything from Wilt. So you're bringing in the strong man, and then you got to think about this. You're gonna face the Russell Celtics in the finals. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. Let's get Wilt, and we've got Jerry. We'll get what we can get out of an aging Baylor, obviously, and some other parts, and Russell will have to guard Wilt in the finals. Russell and Baylor didn't really clash at first. What there was in the offense, because Baylor likes to drive from the left lane to the right side because he's right-handed and come across the lane and swoop and score. They never had, when they had these guys like Counts and Leroy Ellis and Gene Wiley, those guys didn't need to really camp under the basket for a lot of points because they weren't the focus of the scoring. You didn't feed them very often. Wilt did. Wilt posted up down there. He was right where Elgin liked to drive. That was one issue. The egos were not really an issue, but it was more of, it was not that Wilt was coming in wanting to be the leader of Weston Baylor's team, but it was just the way that the offense had to be run to accommodate Wilt, because it was an older Baylor trying to get his shots driving across that same lane. And there was also just the fact that Wilt's not a big practice person. So it's just dealing with everything that was Wilt.
Yeah, and the egos did come to play, however, with Wilt and Van Breidlikoff, which we'll talk about in a moment. But the Lakers actually do win games 1 and 2. West scored 53 points in game 1 and 41 points in game 2. Elgin scored 31 points in game 2, including the 12 final Lakers points in that game. Then Russell decides to double team West in game 3. West at this point is tired out, being exhausted from scoring so much and from so much use. Havlicek scores 42 in that game despite having a swollen eye after getting poked in the eye. The Celtics win game 3. Game 4, very, very close game. Could have easily gone the other way and changed the series, but Sam Jones is able to hit an extremely ugly shot off the wrong foot that somehow drops in and evens the series at 2-2, basically preventing the Lakers from going down, the Celtics from going down 3-1. In game 5, the Lakers do win, but West pulls his hamstring late in that game and is carried off the court. He does return for game six, but the Celtics win. Russell helps shut down Wilt to only scoring 8 points in game six. And then the final game, it's very famous. We have discussed it on this show previously, but the Celtics see the balloons in the rafters, thousands of balloons, and also a program that shows the celebration plan for when the Lakers win the game and win the series. Russell and the Celtics are definitely use some colorful words to in their thoughts on this and say those balloons are staying in the ceiling. And then they go out and they win the game, but it is very close. The Celtics actually have a big lead in the fourth quarter. At one point, it's 98-81. And then the Lakers start to begin a furious comeback led by West. Midway through that, with about 5 minutes left in the game, Chamberlain comes up hobbling on his knee. He comes out of the game. The Lakers continue rolling during that time. And Mel Count actually is a fairly big part of that comeback. And they are down just 103-102. Wilt wants to come back in, but Van Prudnikoff says, no, we're doing fine without you. And continues to plead to come in, but he refuses to do so. Then Don Nelson gets a shot from the free throw line coming off it was tipped from Havlicek, I believe. He hits the jumper from the free throw line. It bounces off the rim into the air and plops right into the basket, and the Celtics are able to pull it out from there in another heartbreaking fashion for the Lakers. Probably the most heartbreaking fashion. I don't know. It'd be hard to rate based on all the other ones. I guess this one coming at the end of this rivalry probably makes it the most heartbreaking because it's coming on top of what had happened before.
Yes, when you've gone that far and you've had a possibility or a window or you're on the precipice with the selfie shot and things of that nature. That many times, and you know, especially for Baylor playing on two damaged knees, that your opportunities are running out. You are really trying to mitigate any predictable barriers to victory or any things that are intangibles that either Russell can take advantage of as a player coach, or that the Celtics can take advantage of on the court. So anything like friction between coach and player, Van Bredikoff earlier in the season telling Wilt to play in a way in which if you just do what Russell does, we'll win the title. And this is at a point in Wilt's career where he's basically focusing on defense and rebounding to say things. And I think one of the big problems with Van Bredikoff Chamberlain, and it even bleeds over into how Baylor and West view Wilt, is that Van Bredikoff Chamberlain had their disputes out in the press.
Yes.
It wasn't limited to the locker room. One would say something about the other, like Van Bredikoff would imply that Wilt is a little unmotivated, or maybe even use the L word that ends in Y. To a reporter. Then Wilt would say something about coach, and he would say it to a reporter, not necessarily, and sort of maybe not even all the times to each other's face, although there was a lot of that too, especially because Wilt wasn't a person that loved to get up and practice or thought much of practice, but neither did Russell. Russell hated practice. Yes. But Auerbach was a different type of coach in terms of his mental handling of players, where he didn't force him to do something that he wasn't doing because they were winning. So being played out in the press, the press had a field day with it, especially LA media, because it's a different era. There's no social media. There's no way to sort of glean or clear your conscience or to rectify or to say, I didn't say that, between editions of the Los Angeles Times or the Los Angeles Examiner or the Nightly News. They didn't like each other, and he was playing a little bit more like Russell. So it's not the Chamberlain that the Philly and San Francisco coaches had complained about. When he banged his knee and didn't go back in, the fallout of that is that Russell criticized him for it for decades. So that's the long-term fallout that sort of entered the game's history. The immediate fallout was that we don't know whether Van Bredekhoff literally didn't put him back in because of the beef between the two, or didn't put him back in because he really did feel Counts was doing better, because the best Counts is not Wilt. The other thing about it is Wilt is not guarding a guy that needs the ball to score a lot. So even though Wilt is playing more like Russell at that stage of his career, he's actually younger than Russell, in the finals, Wilt isn't guarding a guy that takes a lot of shots. Now, it does, Wilt blocking shots and focusing on that later in his career does help you dissuade other people from coming in the lane and scoring, like a Havlicek, like a Sam, guys like that, Larry Siegfried. But it's interesting that Wilt focusing on becoming a defensive player would probably have been more important if they were playing a guy like, say, a Lou Alcindor, or maybe later on a Dave Cowens, or maybe even more so than Russell or Willis Reed, but it's not quite as important with Russell. So, you know, I don't like to come down just on Van Bredekhoff's side with all of these things, but it also made Baylor and West uncomfortable because the writers would always ask them, since they were the leaders, what do you think about what Butch Van Bredekhoff said, or what do you think about what Wilt said? Yeah. They would always have to, they were sort of peacemaker, not peacemakers, because they didn't even get into it. They didn't really get into it. They just wanted to get this monkey off their backs, and having Wilt was supposed to get the monkey off their backs. Yes. Of finally dethroning Boston. Yes. Didn't happen.
No. But they do finally win the championship, unfortunately, after Baylor's retirement in 72 against the Knicks. So they,
West got a ring on the court.
Yes. Yes, and Wilt, of course, as well. So, so before the end, they do have a, they aren't able to do it against the Celtics, but they certainly are a great accomplishment for them. Unfortunately, Baylor, having retired, he was given a ring, but it was not a but he retired earlier in the season because of that. After, you know, just no longer being able to
trying to give it a go.
Yes, exactly. So,
and they had Jim McMillan, and he really felt, you know, 9 games in, this isn't fair. I mean, yeah, it's not really fair.
Yeah. Before we go, anything else you want to, anything else we should talk about?
Well, I just think it's important for people that are, like, you know, I would say 18 to 40 to understand the dynamics of a 10 to 11 team league, the fact that you knew the other players' moves, but that doesn't mean you could stop a Bob Pettit or an Oscar Robertson or an Elgin Baylor just because you knew what they were going to do. The element of, I think those guys, between 62 and 69, the Celtics and Lakers, to the fans and media, were the Dodgers and Yankees of the 50s and early 60s. Well, I say 50s because when they moved to Brooklyn, it's a little different. They did play the Yankees, I think, in one World Series after they moved to LA. But it's sort of the Dodgers and the Yanks. But it became a little bit too much like the Dodgers and the Yanks in one sense, if you throw out that Johnny Padres year in 1955. So the rivalry did become this this annual ritual to basketball fans and press. And it was a perfect ritual. It kind of prefaced the ritual of the 80s, because one team was from the East Coast and one team was from 3,000 miles away. Then you had Auerbach, but, you know, you have a succession of coaches, mostly Shouse on the LA side. You had LA, which is Tinseltown, and West taking these long jump shots or driving to the hoop, and Baylor with his inimitable style, as much as Dr. J and people like that tried to assimilate that style. He was the first anyone saw do it. And the purple and gold uniforms, or before that, the purple and white uniforms, and playing in the sports arena in the Forum, juxtaposed with the old Boston Garden with the dead spots on the parquet floor and the too cold locker room with the temperature turned down. So it was a beautiful rivalry in the sense of the contrast, And it prefaced, as I stated, the rivalry that we would get with Bird and Magic. So it was almost exactly, you know, the working class and the black guy, the white guy, the guy that was 25 years old when he left college and the guy that was 19 year old when he left college. They're both 6'9" and they can both pass. Right. So that set up the stage for the people that were old enough to have seen both to get into the subsequent Boston LA rivalry. And I think, again, it's important for people to know that I don't know about the fans so much because they only met on that stage once a year. But Philly and Boston was also a rivalry too because they always had to get through Philly in the East. And those were series when fans threw things at the teams and there was a lot of booing and Boston is dead chance and things of that nature. And Philly getting over the hump in 66-67, ironically with Wilt, that at least for the players and the observers, there was a drama every year in the NBA Finals of these Boston-LA series where Boston's superstar was sort of a defensive player. And then LA had these two, you know, twin offensive scoring machines in Baylor and West. So it was really like, can the best, and this is how the media sort of posed it to the general public. Can the best team beat the best players? And every year that Baylor was active, the best team beat the best players.
That's a great way of putting it.
Although in retrospect, everybody on that team that was more balanced ends up in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think people, I mean, obviously the Celtics did play incredibly well as a team and they, you know, that teamwork was a lot, but I mean, they had some incredible players too. I mean, they couldn't have been an incredible team without having incredible players. They just had guys who just worked so well together for so many years. And obviously mm-hmm. Russell being the most important piece in that, but a lot of guys who were really important pieces in that, and what the Lakers had was great, but it just wasn't quite as great as what the Celtics had so many times.
There's two things that you don't want to be if you're in the NBA. You don't want to be born around 1934, 35, or 36, and you don't want to be born around 1963 or 64.
Yeah.
If you want a championship. if you were born in 34, 35, 36, you have a great career, do all kinds of things, set records, score 100 points in a game. Well, Wilt won two championships, so we'll take him out of that. But sure. In terms of being born at the wrong time, I would say if you're a certain people, you don't want to be born. You don't want to be a contemporary of Bill Russell, and you don't want to be a contemporary of Michael Jeffrey Jordan.
Yeah. Well said. So everyone should definitely check out Elgin Baylor, the man who changed basketball. Is there anything else you'd like to let people know about, or where they can follow you on Twitter, or what have you?
Yeah, sure. On Twitter, it's at Bijan C. Bain, the spelling of my name, B-I-J-A-N C. Bain, middle initial C. And I really want to thank you guys for having me on. This is an important series. And as I stated, you really don't appreciate Russell because I didn't see him. I came, my fandom started the year after he left. I saw Hank Finkel and John Havlicek. So I saw Alcindor's rookie year, but you really don't think about what he accomplished until you really factor in his focus on a statistic that wasn't even being tallied while he was playing. That's really something.
Yeah,
it would be like being a monumental. I can't even say goalie with saves because you're always going to count saves. But it would be like, I don't know if you know, put outs at a certain position in baseball, or you know, if we didn't have a way of logging fumble recoveries. There's really no analog in major sports history. And I, as much as his psychological presence is appreciated and his physical gifts, the combination of the two, it's astounding that with all the shot blockers that we've had since, you know, whether they be the Olajuwons, whether they be the Mark Eatons, whether they be David Robinson, that formula hasn't been able to be replicated where a person could dominate the game for that long without having to have the ball in their hands. I mean, Robinson and Duncan and all those guys are scorers.
Yeah, I absolutely. And basically to invent the way that defense is played. I mean, really, I mean, that's what he did. I mean, basically, just kind of revolutionized the entire way that defense was played in, and to be such a, you know, a pioneer, and to, be able to, you know, lead the way for other black athletes to, you know, make their mark in the NBA, and the, you know, and of course that being important in a, you know, for sports reasons and for cultural reasons and for, you know, for all kinds of reasons. So he really is on both the basketball side of things and the winning side of things and the, you know, cultural side of things. He's such an important figure. And I'm glad we can do this series to help highlight some of those things, which, you know, which I've learned about since doing this research and gained a new appreciation for.
No, you've really done your homework. I think the only credible analog is Deacon Jones getting 26 sacks in 1967 when the NFL didn't count sacks.
Yes.
And Deacon Jones naming them sacks.
That's good. Yes, that would probably be that would probably be the closest thing that I could think of. That absolutely is the case. So so thank you, sir, for go ahead.
I really appreciate you having me on, and I really appreciate the informed nature of the questions.
Well, thank you. And thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at hardwoodparoxysm.com. We are on iTunes and Stitcher. You can search for Over and Back. Please leave a rating and a review if you enjoy the podcast. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening. And until next time, we'll be back again soon.